Jean-Baudin Rosca dirige un laboratoire Friedrich Mischer Institut à Bâle. Il a longtemps travaillé à Berkeley et à Harvard. Il collabore avec nous depuis des années. Il y a ici Jens Dubel qui est un de ses élèves, qui est à l'Institut de la Vision maintenant. Et il va vous développer tout le travail sur l'optogénétique. J'ai délibérément laissé le sujet entièrement pour lui parce qu'il vous en présentera une vision très large.
Thank you very much. I'd like to now talk about optogenetics. And optogenetics is really intimately connected with a very deep question in neuroscience. Indeed, the question in the neuroscience is that how can we understand the brain? And what I'd like to do first is go back in evolution to a time when there were no brains and brains just developing, and try to show you how these very primitive brains might have worked and what they can do. And then going through these steps, I'd like you then to realize that you need techniques that are very specific. And indeed, it will come very naturally that optogenetics is a very good solution for understanding the brain. But I'd like to sort of go through the journey of evolution that you realize that why is it so popular technique these days. So imagine if we go back in evolution to a stage when an organism has only two cells. There are no regular neurons at this stage, but there is a sensory cell, let's say a photoreceptor, which is connected to a muscle cell. And the sensory cell, in this case a photoreceptor, can respond to light. And imagine there is some light flicker some out there in the environment in time. So the light level goes up and down, and there's a big time up and down. So that is, you know, this light is flickering around. And the photoreceptor would copy this. It's a very good photoreceptor, so it faithfully copies the response of the light input. And this, the photoreceptor response itself is changing its voltage. It's an analog little cell that is very faithfully following the light intensity outside, and they're releasing a chemical along the same time course to the muscle. And the way the muscle reacts, it contracts. So the muscle then will contract, and this change in the muscle length is again very faithfully following this time course of photoreceptor voltage. Now this is change, you know, the muscle contracts a little bit and relaxes again, big contraction and relaxation, and this is the response of this muscle to light. So you can think this system as an input-output system. The input is the light changing in time, and the output is this muscle contraction, which is a certain behavior of this very primitive little species that has two cells. Now, what I like to, you can think of course, as a real input-output system, then this is the input, this is the output, and what you see here is nothing else, which is a copy machine. Okay, so it's still useful because your pupil, for example, can contract. This is very similar. But there's not much computation, you can see. It's just copying the signal to an action. Now, so let's imagine now evolution goes one step ahead. And there is another cell in between. And this we call neuron. And neurons has really two incredibly interesting compartments. One is what we call the dendrite. This is what is now listening to what the photoreceptor is saying. And then axon that is transmitting something to the muscle cell. And you will see that the interesting thing about this neuron, that is not simply a copy machine, but what the dendrite is listening to will be different, that is transmitting to. So let's see what this can do for you. Again, there's a light flickering with a certain time course here, and the photoreceptor copying with its voltage the light intensity. And now comes something completely new, that and this is the activity measured in the axon. So let's see what happens. That this voltage leads to the release of a chemical called neurotransmitter to the dendrite. So the dendrites follow the same time course, but then somewhere here at the beginning of an axon called axonal hillock, a computation going on, namely that this neuron thresholds this incoming fluctuation. That means that the axon will not transmit most of the signals that below this threshold, but remains silent. But then when it reaches threshold, it produces so-called spikes. These are unit events. This is not anymore an analog neuron. It's creased like 1, 1, 1, 1, 4 times. And then again, it's completely silent. And now this information, that every time when there is a spike, this little tick, then a neurotransmitter is released. So it's tick, 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 tick. It's 4 times. And then it leads to a muscle contraction. But the output now looks completely different. There is no information at the beginning when it's flickering. Then it's a contraction. This is proportional to the frequency of these spikes. And then again, no contraction. And you can see this is very nicely reduces some noise in the flickering. And the output is sort of proportional to this change in light intensity right here. So again now, there is an input and output, but this is much more complex now. So we have an input and the output does not resemble. So even with a single neuron, this is a computer which can do two things. It can threshold and digitize the signal before transmitting. So let me show you my last example, going ahead in evolution, that now let's put one more neuron. So we have two neurons, but these two neurons are different a little bit. One, what we call, is an excitatory neuron, and the other neuron is called an inhibitory neuron. So let me explain that. So an excitatory neuron would release a neurotransmitter that leads to the contraction of the muscle, and the inhibitory neuron would release a neurotransmitter that would give the relaxation of the muscle. So there are several very important points here. One is that this excitatory neuron now, in this little circuitry, they have an axon directly exciting the muscle cell, and it has another axon which now talks to the inhibitory neuron that again leads. So here is a little delay because this has to excite the second cell. And the second important thing is that the fundamental difference between an inhibitory and excitatory neuron. The inhibitory neuron alone cannot do anything because it just the muscle is relaxed. The inhibitory neuron tells the muscle to relax, but it's relaxed. It's not going to do anything, right? So inhibition only makes sense when it comes simultaneously with excitation, and then when inhibitory input comes, that can counteract an excitatory input. Okay, so there is an asymmetry here. So let's say what happens here. Now we get an even more sophisticated computation. We have the input, the photoreceptor response. We have the response of the excitatory cell. Let's see what happens with the inhibitory neuron. The inhibitory neuron now copies the signal from the excitatory neuron through this axon, but a little bit delayed. Okay, so one spike comes a little later than others, and it has very serious consequences to the muscle. The muscle contracts again, but in a completely different time course. So again, there is no activity here. The first spike of the excitatory neuron evokes a contraction, but the next spike comes the same time as the inhibitory spike, and this is canceled out, and you get a transient activation. Indeed, what this is saying is calculating the derivative of the signal, the positive derivative. So it's not only thresholding and digitizing, but also do some calculus. Okay, again, here is the input, the output, and this with two neurons, we can do threshold, digitize, and you can do a little bit of a calculus that you learned in high school. Okay, so this was a very simple circuitry. And over evolution, the circuit expanded to three neurons, and then to many neurons, and to billions of neurons. And that's your brain. Okay, so your brain is absolutely nothing else than what I described, and a little bit knows more because we have more neurons. And you have a big brain, you have billions of neurons, so therefore you can think that these neurons can do all sorts of things. Now, so let's just, your brain is also an input-output system. There's an input to it, and there's an out which we call behavioral, and even very sophisticated thing you believe that, well, it's some very complex human activity. Yes, it's a more adaptable and more flexible input-output system. For example, you write a book. You think that, wow, this is some amazing thing you have done, but indeed what you have done, that each word in the book, you had a sensory experience that went to your brain, and you had a little algorithm that put together these different sensory experiments, a little bit of memory, and then you get an output of the book that has all sorts of meaning to a next person, it will be an input. So the question is that once you have such a sophisticated input output, a billion neurons, how you understand it? Okay, and this is what I just like to show you, that despite This is a simple input-output system in a human. That despite we are thinking we are extremely complex, we sort of preserved a lot of things from evolution. Even the very simple reflexes we kept, except we build on a lot of other things. So we will talk a lot about behavioral and inputs. And here is the simplest behavioral we can imagine. We shine light to the pupil, and the pupil contracts. You see the pupil contracting. This is what you can do it without a brain. But we have a brain, and we do it anyways. This is a bit more complex in us. OK, so before getting into how to study this system, I have to tell you two more things about these neurons. And one is ultimately connected with, are we similar to computers, that digital computers? And we have to ask, is all the neurons the same? I already told you that there is not, because there are at least two types, excitatory and inhibitory. But we think about how we build computers. We take loads of little things, elements, which are very similar, transistors, and we connect them together to do something very complicated. And one question is that, is our brain is similar? And the answer is big time no. And this was already discovered hundreds of years ago by Ramón y Cajal, who did a very simple thing. He went to a part of the brain, this particular case is the retina, and he had a technique to light up neurons, so they visualize neurons, and he started to make drawings. And if you look at this, his drawing, you can immediately realize that the cells, the individual neurons, have very, very different morphologies. That's one point. So he accounted approximately, or we know about 80 different morphologies. So it's not just a transistor that is connected in a very sophisticated way, but they're very different elements. And the second thing he noted, which is extremely important, that he not only encountered once an element, but every element out of the 80 repeats itself. So we can talk about a cell type. The cell type is a concept of a neuron, the similar morphology that you will later see, not only morphology, but function and genetics is also similar. Okay, but he also noted that he can go to other brain regions when the situation is not so simple. For example, in this part, this is a cortex here, or you can look at the hippocampus. He looks at the excitatory neurons, and they look just about the same. So if you look at them, they are not so different. And yet, there's another concept that we can group some of these neurons, and that's what we call relevant cells. So let me explain that, which is also very, very important for optogenetics. Namely, is a very famous experiment, people recording from the hippocampus or the temporal cortex and showing all sorts of images of famous people. These are recording from humans during a surgery for epilepsy. And then they are showing recording from single neurons, and they're showing all sorts of famous pictures. This surgery was in Los Angeles, so these people probably have known who they are. And very amusingly, there was a neuron that responded specifically to one of these faces, Halle Berry, and another face, which is the same one but a different setting, and to the drawing of her. And also, when you write down Halle Berry, these neurons responded. So these are so-called concept neurons. But the amusing things about this is not that you can find these neurons, but that what the amusing things was that not every neuron in the neighborhood responded to them, but not only one responded, but several. So you account it as it almost behaves similarly. They look identical to you, but they respond. So there must be a little circuitry here, hidden underlying, that although they look identical, they are relevant for a certain behavioral activity. So keep in mind, we can talk about cell types in some parts of the brain. In other parts of the brain, there are also some cell types, but also some relevant cells relevant for a particular behavior. Okay, so we are back to our first question, that we have this complex circuitry with cell types, relevant cells, a billion neurons, and it leads to behavior. And the fundamental question in neuroscience is that how can we explain the behavior with the dynamic activity of the cells in the brain? So the simplest way to understand, to go for this question is to simply perturb the system and check how behavior gets perturbed. That's the simplest thing we can do with differential equations or physics, anything you do, that we do something with it, a little bit push it and see what the output is doing. So the question is that how to perturb. And during the history of neuroscience, of course, things first started with gross manipulation, which was very instructive, but is not enough. So for example, What I mean by gross manipulation, that if you have an if you have a blood clot, for example, a part of your brain goes away, or if you get a shot in a war, that you get a mass injury at a part of the brain, that leads to a change of behavior. Indeed, we learned a lot about this gross manipulation that happened as accident to us. But of course, as you can see, that this is a highly complex dynamic system, and this is not enough to shoot out parts to look at them. So what we really need are manipulations of or perturbation at cellular resolution. And the difficulty that you can take an electrode, you can go to a single cell in your brain, but you might already wonder that one out of a billion, even if you have a neuron in you, it will not make a big difference for you. So we have to start to go for a class of neurons with a similar property. And this is led to the invention of optogenetics. So optogenetics is an incredibly simple thing to do, which is turn neurons to photoreceptors and control them by light. And you will see this whole idea came from actually the visual system. And there are three parts of it. You have to somehow address these neurons. They have the ability to manipulate neurons. Then they have the ability to turn particular neurons to photoreceptors. And then you use light, and the nice thing with light that you can remotely control. Not very remotely, we wish to have more remotely, but reasonably remotely, you don't have to put an electrode and mess around with the circuitry. And you can see with a single light source, you can control many neurons if they have some similar properties. So I looked to go through a little bit of the history of optogenetics. And this all started with Gary Misenberg, who really had the idea of optogenetics, and he created the first attempt to use optogenetics. And what he thought was really what I just showed you at the beginning. He thought that if photoreceptors can be remotely controlled, all what I want to do is create a photoreceptor from a neuron. And he had a very ingenious idea how to do it, namely that he knew that fly photoreceptors needs around 10 genes, 10 proteins, to create a light response. He simply said that likely 10 is too much. This has all sorts of modulatory proteins. So let's find the minimum set that's able to control. And he found that 3 genes is enough to turn a cell to a photoreceptor. And then he put them into neurons. So let me just first show his very first experiment, indeed the first optogenetic experiment ever made. So what he did, he converted in flies those neurons that control the wings and flight, therefore, into photoreceptors. And so here is his first attempt. He shines light, hop, and then the fly start to try to fly away. It doesn't succeed, but you can see its wings are moving. And there is, of course, you realize there's a fundamental problem with this experiment. Anyone realizes what could be the problem? That, of course, the fly also has vision, so you don't know if it was the photoreceptors or was what you controlled. But Gary had an ingenious idea, a simple idea, that he then simply removed the head of the flies. And surprisingly, flies survive without a head. And of course, that eliminated the problem. And so then he tried a second time. And his attempt now with flies that are no head. Here's again, flies goes away. You can be absolutely sure that this behavior was controlled by those neurons that he inserted the optogenetic sensors. The problem with this approach was that it only worked in Gary's lab, not because it wasn't an ingenious one, because it worked. It needed 3 genes. And whenever you have 3 parameters, you can imagine that the expression levels are changing from neuron to neuron, and you have 3 parameters to optimize. This is incredibly hard. So what we needed is a system which is simple enough that reproducibly works in everybody's laboratory. Therefore, a single gene system, a single protein that can sense light and inject a current in the neuron, creating spiking. And this is really done by three German researchers, Ernst Bomberg, Peter Hegemann, and Georg Nagel. And they were biophysicists that are working with algae and bacteria. They spent their entire life characterizing the light responses of algae and bacteria. And you can see already the argumentation is that the first attempt came from Drosophila. Drosophila is already very developed. So once you want to get a simpler system, you go back in evolution to single cells that can sense light, hoping that they will be simpler, the whole machinery. And indeed, it is simple. And what they discovered is two genes, channelrhodopsin and halorhodopsin, that directly responded to light. And they had the idea to take these genes and put it into cells, other cells, and show that they can work in a completely different, in hex cells, other cells which are not neurons or not the algae, and give them light sensitivity. And so channelrhodopsin is a light-gated channel, and if you shine light, it opens the channel and ions can flow in, causing to an injection of a current, and therefore a depolarization and increase in voltage. And the opposite is caused by halorhodopsin, which is a light-gated pump. So this research led to the demonstration that there you can do with a single gene, but and the next step was to really put into neurons and show that it actually can work in species like flies and mice and perhaps humans. So this is done by Caldesaroth and Ed Boyden. So they were the first who inserted these genes into neurons. And one thing I didn't mention here is that the difference between these two different proteins is that you can control by blue light channelrhodopsin and by yellow light halorhodopsin. And so this is the first experiment done with channelrhodopsin and halorhodopsin. So you can see that they're recording from a single neuron that is transduced by halorhodopsin and channelrhodopsin, so both genes. And when they flash blue light here, the neuron produces a spike. This is the output of a neuron. And when they continuously keep a yellow light on, the same blue light is unable to exert its effects. So you have a bimodal activation of neurons. You can inhibit them and excite them. Okay, so that really brought optogenetics to neurons. And from here, of course, the whole field exploded. And I just show you that you can remotely now control mice. This is an experiment for Carr's lab, where he inserts now channelrhodopsin in this case into some neurons. And when he turns on the light, he can control the mouse remotely. Very nice. He's a little fiber up there. The mouse is circling. And then when you turn off the light, the behavior is gone. So now you can imagine that you can put into any sort of neuron you want, and you can start to learn of activating, inactivating neurons, what these cells do. Of course, a cautionary note is that activation is a dangerous thing to do. Because we have a very complex circuitry, and if I activate a neuron and get a behavior, it does not mean that the same neuron, that the neuron does when it's normally active. Because we don't know if that neuron was actually activated ever. Maybe it was a silent neuron. So in that sense, inactivation is a more proper way to go because it is a normal behavior. You inactivate a neuron and you can be sure that there was a normal pattern that you can inhibit. So there is a little magic in this that I showed you. And the magic is that, yes, you have a gene and you have a complex network. But the question is that, how you can insert in a particular cell type. And if this is a question, is that how to target cell type and how to target relevant cells. So this leads to, again, a fundamental insight into neuroscience, namely that turns out that the cells that have different morphologies, which you can number them here, also have very unique gene expression pattern. What it means that every neuron, of course, have the same DNA in it, but not every gene is expressed in every neuron. And it turns out that, let's say, let's say half of a third of the genes are expressed in a given neuron, but it's a different set expressed in one neuronal cell type than the other one. And as a general rule, usually if you see a neuron with a different morphology, you can be sure that you will find genes that are differentially expressed. So now one can use this idea of differential gene expression to target cell types. And the way to do this is first to obtain a map of gene expression from your favorite brain area. So my favorite brain area is the retina. And so we work there. There are a lot of people here, collaborators in Paris. And we have created an atlas of cell type transcriptomes. So these numbers refer to different cell types in different classes. And what I show here that for every single cell type, you get an expression of, let's say, 20,000 genes. And for, let's say, this cell type 7, you can order them by specificity. So this gene is the most specifically expressed in cell type 7. And for every cell type, you can create an atlas like that. What you end up is a list of genes that are specifically expressed. And from this list now, you can do all sorts of interesting things. The first you can do is you can create a transgenic mouse expressing an optogenetic sensor, like you have seen before. And today we have loads of technologies, including CRISPR engineering, TALEN engineering, to create this mouse. But of course, these are not so useful for human use or later for medicine. And the second option to go is to go through these little viruses that introduced you by José, these adeno-associated viral vectors, engineer them to somehow to smell the barcode. Like, that's the game. The game that you know the barcode in the cell, and you like to create viruses that smell the barcode. So how do we do that? If we look into these viral vectors, they really look like this famous German chocolate, which has an exterior, a shell, and a core. And the you can engineer separately both, and Denise Dalcara is very well known of her extremely nice engineering of the shell. And if you look at the core, and we are working on engineering this core, and within the core, you see a single DNA strand. And in this single DNA strand, you can put an address and some tools. Okay? So the address is the one that I'm talking about right now. The tools are the optogenetic sensors and, for example, a fluorescent tag. And what we call this is a specific promoter. And this is really a meaningless word, a completely meaningless word, because all what we mean by that is that we are guessing some DNA sequence that can smell out the transcription factors or can bind transcription factors within the cell that give specificity. And really, we don't know often why and how. We just have ideas, and one can screen them. So using this screening, one can then find different AAVs that can give you specificity. This AAV will enter the cells, but if it doesn't have the right transcription cocktail, it will not express. So that's the idea behind it. But I keep emphasizing that very often you hear this word promoter, and this is really meaningless entities, because what is a promoter, for example, in the normal DNA, it's not a promoter in the viral DNA and vice versa. We have all sorts of ideas. At the end, we test out and we can get the virus that's specifically expressed. And the procedure really works very well, except you have to work a lot. So here is, for example, a retina. It's a degenerated retina. I talk about it later. And you inject the virus and it keeps all cells completely empty of expression except of a single cell type. Okay, so the last point I like to mention about targeting is to how to target the relevant cells. And this is important because, as I told you, that in the cortex, for example, a number of neurons look very identical, but they have different functions. And this is a really ingenious trick that people at MIT figured, that is, there are genes that are activity dependent. So when neurons are very highly active, there are some genes that turn on. So activity comes with gene expression. And so what you can do, a trick, is you can create a mice and we exchange the gene with a tag. Okay? So what you gain is that the mouse is, or your fly or whatever, your genetic animal is engaged in a specific behavior, these neurons are highly active, and therefore they will express a tag in these neurons, the ones that were active. For example, you happen to look at a face that you know very well, and these neurons will be tagged if you have that particular transgenic capability. Now, you come with an AV, just what I described, but such that this AV is now conditional on the presence of a tag. So it's an AND gate, it's a logical AND gate, so you only get expression if you have the AV plus you have the tag, and then you turn these neurons into photoreceptors. So this is a two ways you can label neurons, either by behaviorally tagged or you tag by cell typing. Okay, so far we discussed how can we understand the brain using optogenetics, but the talk by José Sahel started by looking at therapies. And I wouldn't be here if I wouldn't talk about therapies, but now you can understand that you can control cell types by almost wish in the brain. And the question is that what is useful for medicine? And the answer is we don't yet know, but certainly the most natural way of thinking about therapy in the case of optogenetics is vision restoration, for the simple reason because your whole visual system already uses photoreceptors. So it makes sense that if you become blind, we try to convert some cells in the visual system into photoreceptors. So it's a very natural concept for optogenetics, for repair, and this is what we are working in collaboration with the Vision Institute, my lab, and several other labs. So I'd like to now concentrate on turning from basic science into translational science, and I'd like to go through, before showing you the different strategies, a little bit of educating you on the retina. I've already done it about the circuitry of the retina. I've done it 2 months ago, but I like to repeat. So this is the picture you have already seen in José's talk, that you have the eye and the back of it is the retina, and you have an optical system to focus the light, and then a complex circuitry of approximately 80 cell types. And very importantly, the retina is a layered structure, as shown here. What the way we think about the retina, and that gives the complexity, that the retina is an image processor, but it has the ability to extract at least 20 different features from the visual scene. So when you look at my face, indeed, in your brain, there are 20 different versions of my face, or even more, are pouring towards your cortex. And the way it is done is that you have a photoreceptor. During daylight, these are called the cones. During nighttime, these are called the rod photoreceptors. And then the cones are talking to bipolar cells. And importantly, you will see it is very important for optogenetics, we have 10 types of bipolar cells coming in 2 major flavors. So that's why I only show you 2 here. One that is activated by light, and the second one is activated by the decrease of light intensity. So one is activated by an increase of light intensity, other one by the decrease of light intensity. And we have these inhibitory neurons that are the computational elements. And finally, a so-called ganglion cell that transfers information to the brain. What is very important here is that you have 3 levels of processing. You have a level of processing at the photoreceptors, the bipolar cells, and then the ganglion cells. So if you think about losing your photoreceptor capability to respond to light, you can already see that the best strategy we could think of would be to replace the or to bring back activity to the photoreceptor cell. So if the photoreceptor cell body is alive, then the best strategy we can use conceptually is to resensitize the photoreceptor light by optogenetic sensor. And the reason for that, because there's a lot of computation after that. And we don't know, there are like 20 different computations. If that is not possible, as José told you, because of the stage of degeneration, the next best is to come back to bipolar cells, because there's less computation done in bipolar cells than at the ganglion cell level. And finally, if the degeneration is final, we have to go to ganglion cells. Okay, but it all, of course, depends. This is easy to say, but it depends of our ability in humans to transduce cells with particular promoters and particular cell types. And this is the big challenge as of today, as I'll explain you later. So this, just as showed you before, the retina is also an input-output system. It has a light intensity coming in and spikes coming out. And here's a little circuitry I just showed you that is present in one point in space. So if you look at Federer's face, one little circuitry is looking at one patch, and then we have a mosaic of circuitry looking at all the face. And this mosaic of circuitry is the base, the fundamental unit of the retina, which looks at a visual scene and extracts a particular feature. And your retina has approximately 20 such circuitry, so you have 20 representations of Federer's face, of my face, or any face you are looking at. And that is the fundamental challenge for visual restoration. The fundamental challenge is that even though the retina is probably the simplest part of the brain, it's a small computer. So we have to come up with strategies that are reasonable to bring back some activity that is relevant for patients. Okay, so how do we do that? We look at the disease, and Jose already explained to you, retinitis pigmentosa is a blinding condition where you lose your rod photoreceptors and that you mostly don't care because you just turn on the light at higher intensity. And the real trouble comes when you lose the central cones, which leads to blindness. And again, as Jose told you, that there are many different mutations that leads to a similar disease pathology. And I just like to tell you the real problem with all sorts of methods of visual restoration, namely that many of these patients come to the office of the doctor when they already lost most of the rod photoreceptors. So either you know the family very early and you come with therapies that is supporting the rods, not losing the rods, or by the time the rods come in, you lost the genes that leading to the degeneration. Therefore, we have to act. You cannot restore any more the rods if they are lost, these cells. Okay, so let's. We have a very good research tools for studying retinitis pigmentosa. These are mice models. These are two different models. This is a study that actually Jens Dübel and has been working together with Volker Buskamp many years ago. And you see this is a normal photoreceptor layer, retinitis pigmentosa. It sort of reduces to a single layer of what we call dormant cones. And so you end up with a circuitry that has no photoreceptors or no light sensitivity, some dormant cones. And here what we got is that you have a circuitry and you want to make photoreceptors using optogenetic tools. And the key point here is that I described eugenorhodopsin and halorhodopsin as one of them leading to activation of neurons, another one leading to the inactivation of neurons. And this really fits well the retina because we have on cells which are turned on by light and we have off cells turned off by light. So for on cells, you tend to use eugenorhodopsin. And for off cells, you tend to be using halorhodopsin to gain back their normal activity. And here is just a reminder that we have two families of tools, and today we have more than 100 different optogenetic tools one can choose from. One important point mentioned by Jose is that if you want to restore some visual capability, you have to carefully look at the species you want to restore it. So mice has a fundamentally different retinal organization than humans. And that is that all primates, including us, we have an area called the fovea, which has extremely high density of cone photoreceptors. But the real problem is not that. The real problem is that at the high intensity, the circuitry is, normally the circuitry is that you have a photoreceptor, under that is a bipolar cell, and under that is a ganglion cell. But in your fovea, the ganglion cells and the bipolar cells are shuffled away because the light is actually coming from here. They can directly hit the photoreceptors. And this is now you don't disturb, but it creates a big problem for optogenetics because then we stimulate with an array of light. So if we would have the bipolar cells all pile on each other, there's no way to stimulate them in the fovea. So within the fovea, you basically have only one option, and looking for the cell bodies of cone photoreceptors. And if you use other strategies, like ganglionsiders, you might have to figure out very complex ways of stimulations or move away the fovea. Fortunately, it's possible to use clever stimulation strategies to distort the stimulus, but then, of course, again, you will have to follow the fovea where it is and distort in a proper way. Okay, so now imagine that you understand all about the retina and you want to design a way of restoring vision. And the first thing you notice is that the only way to do it if you understand the retina. And I like to keep emphasizing that medicine completely depends on understanding of a particular system. So in this case, there was at least 100 years of retina research. We understand most of the elements, what they do. So it's possible to come up with a strategy that, you know, we can go for dormant cones, we can go for this type of bipolar cell, that type of bipolar cell, and some other, and ganglions and other phase. But it's very important to note that depends on 100 years of knowledge of the circuitry, which cell type to target. And once you come up, then you work another 10 years to come up with viruses that have the ability to actually target those cell types that you selected. And in mouse, we can do it extremely well. So all those four I showed you, we have a virus that specifically targets these cell types. The real challenge is that what works in mice doesn't necessarily work in humans. So you have to come up with a strategy how you move from mouse all the way to humans. That includes doing experiment first in mice to prove that you can restore circuitry, you can say function at the retinal level. You have to look at the behavior of mice, but then the question how to translate that into humans. And the very important technology here developed by Serge Picot here in the Vision Institute by his team, Valiv Frado and other people, that they had the idea of take postmortem human retinas and culture them in a dish. And turns out you can culture for quite a long time, and that gives a wonderful model for truly human retina. And without that, I think that, and that together with in vivo primate study, without the two steps, it would be completely impossible to go to humans, because the promoters, the viruses, sometimes work similarly than in mice, and sometimes not. You have to test it. There is no other way than to test it before one goes for patient selection that is actually ongoing here in Paris. So let me just show you one example out of these four different ways of restoring vision, or five different ways I showed you, and this is done by Jens Dübel and Volker Buskamp. Jens Dübel is here in Paris. Volker Buskamp now is in Dresden. And as I told you, you have to come up with a promoter, you have to choose an optogenetic sensor and a fluorescent tag. And once you have it, then you can inject into mice, and you can see that in mice, these promoters work really well. You transduce the photoreceptors, and in the case of this retinitis pigmentosa model, FRD, fast RD model, you have a single layer of cones left here, and then the rest of the photoreceptor disappeared. So one fundamental question is that how do we know that these cells are actually cones? And this really haunted us for a long time, because this is a normal cone, this is how a normal cone looks, and all what you see in your mice, that you have cells that are green, but otherwise look completely different than the cones. So either you believe that these are cones, or you need a proof. And the proof is, this is usually genetic proof, is that we can sort these cells out, determine the gene expression pattern, and show that indeed the gene expression pattern are similar of the cones, but not of rods and other cell types. So that's the proof that these are actually dormant cones. And then Jens looked at the activity of these cones, and if you only express the control, where there's no optogenetic tool except of GFP, then you see there's no activity, and when you express the optogenetic tool, you see this very large current developing when you shine light, peaking at yellow light, it's around 580 nanometer its peak. That's why you have to use yellow light, because that causes the largest current. Of course, that this tells you that the photoreceptors respond to light, but doesn't tell you that it's enough to drive the retina. So then you can go to the other side of the retina, to the ganglion cells, and record activity. And you see that in the mouse models for degeneration, there's absolutely no activity. And when you restore, you bring halorhodopsin to the cones, then you get almost normal light activity. And then you can look at retinal computations and show that indeed the retina not only responds to light, but can start to compute. And this is very, very interesting because many of you heard that if neurons degenerate, they disconnect from the circuitry. And turns out to be that might be the rule in some part of the nervous system, but not in the retina. The retina is somehow a genetic device that doesn't need any activity to correct properly, or very little activity. And this just shows you that because this mouse was completely blind until adulthood, when Jens and Volker reintroduced halorhodopsin to bring back visual activity, and then more or less the retinal circuitry computed as normal. Well, there are some differences. So that shows us that really coming in adult is actually a viable strategy for the retina. Importantly, brain development might be somewhat different. So we likely can only go to patients that had some vision and lost it, but not those that never had vision. Indeed, those patients, I believe, that never had vision is very rare. If not, I think most patients have some visual activity before losing them. Okay, and finally, one can look at behavior in mice to test the vision that is restored. And as I told you, that mice, we become very almost perfect in restoring vision to mice, except this is completely irrelevant for the final goal, which is to restore in humans. And we learned a hard lesson, is that a problem in basic science is that we have the goals to go somewhere, and then we, for a while, we're going in the right track, and then we go take a side route, and we completely go in a different direction. And the different direction is, and the mistake that very often happens in basic or translational science, that we become better and better to treat mice. And become so good that we want to improve it furthermore. And we don't ask the question, is that whether improving mouse vision restoration would that help actually our final goal for humans? So we lost a lot of time of improving vision restoration to mice, not thinking that, well, the vectors, the promoters, this all might or might not work. And so very important, research developed this model, this human model, where you can test your promoters. And it's very important that all the, when you go to the details of engineering viruses, it should be tested in primates and in humans and not necessarily in mice. Mouse is a good starting point, but not the end point. Here is just showing you that a human retina that is infected with a virus with halorhodopsin and is a measurement by Jens from this cell showing you activity in human cones. We are still not there to have the best promoters for cones and bipolar cells. We are getting close to have it in ganglion cells. We still work lies ahead. But I'd like to finally tell you the final dilemma and the solution to that in vision restoration optogenetics, namely the sensitivity of halorhodopsin and chernodopsin and all optogenetic sensors is much less than your light sensitivity. But even more importantly, these sensors cannot adapt. So you have the immense capability that you can go to a very dark room, and after 10 minutes, you can start to see the details. And after that, you can go to the beach, and again, after 10 minutes, you can see. And there are at least 10 log units of intensity differences. And the optogenetic sensors can tolerate around 2.5 log units, but not 10 log units. And for this reason, we need an outside device that has a video camera. It converts then. The video camera can adapt, indeed, many log units because we have fancy computers in it. And then project the light to the retina, which is in the appropriate light intensity. And the nice thing with this, which is currently developed in Paris, by GenSight, a small company that works on it, is that you, in doing this, you can tune the intensity and the color of the light you're using on the other side. So the video camera is just a standard video camera. On the other side, you can choose whatever light intensity and wavelength you want that fits your sensor, and then show a movie to the eye. Okay, so this is where I would like to stop and summarize what I talked today about. I started with optogenetics, its usefulness to study brain, and historically, this is started with this famous experiment by Gary Meisenberg with the headless flies that were able to fly away because he controlled the neurons by light. And then this was too complex for the field because it needed three genes that could reduced by three German researchers to a single one. And they had two different ones, chenodopsin to activate and helodopsin to inactivate neurons. That was then used by Dicerot and Boyden to control neurons and then control behavior in mice. And now we can freely control just about what we want in mice. And the key challenge now to use it for something that is relevant for humans, and this translational is really ongoing with the center being here in the Vision Institute. And we hope that different forms will arrive to the clinic in different pace. But hopefully this will be actually useful for patients. So thank you very much for your attention.